readers, welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and today we're going to explore the power of two, T-W-O. So here's what I mean. I'm not talking about a man, a woman, a true love. Nope. If you're like me, when you discover a book by an author you haven't read before, and you fall in love with it, then boom, you're hooked. You're on a quest to read more, the next title from the same author, The Power of Two. So, I've spent this week prowling through titles we all loved in the last few years. Some are books hot off the presses. Some are an earlier work that a savvy publisher is putting out there now to ride the wave of popularity. Question is, are they worthy? Let's see, as we turn to page one of the book report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well-represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
Garth Stein's The Art of Racing in the Rain was on everyone's favorite list in 2008. This heart warmer was told by Enzo, a very wise lab terrier mix. I know I read it, wiped away the tears, and recommended it to friends. We previewed it recently last August, and you'll find it on bookreportradio.com, archived shows, week of August 20th and 21st. Now that Stein is something of a household name, his first novel from 1998, Raven Stole the Moon, has just been reissued. So, is this marketing ploy a good thing for readers? Here's the story. Jenna and husband Robert were living the American dream in Seattle, complete with their 5-year-old son Bobby, a fancy BMW, and Robert's fast-track job in real estate. The family takes a vacation to Alaska, where tragedy strikes. Their son Bobby drowns on a fishing excursion. 2 years later, on the anniversary of his death, Jenna impulsively leaves her husband and their deteriorating marriage and heads north. She's drawn to Alaska, to her mother's hometown, coincidentally close to the spot where Bobby died. There she encounters Tlingit spirits. Jenna, herself part Tlingit, delves deeper into the tribe's culture and begins to believe their spirits might hold answers she's been searching for. One of the legends tells of the spirits called Kushtaka, who take the form of either otters or furry humanish creatures that lead people to their death, then kidnap their souls before they can get to the afterlife. I did a little research, and interestingly, Garth Stein's ancestry is also diverse. Though born in L.A. and raised in Seattle, his mother is an Alaskan native of Tlingit Indian and Irish descent. His dad, a Brooklyn native, the child of Jewish immigrants from Austria. Readers, I'm certainly open to books about spirituality and spirits, as you'll see later in the show. But this title was kind of quirky, and I felt it didn't just hold together. Raven Stole the Moon is ultimately about getting through grief, searching for closure, and it has its moments. But it's not in the same league as Racing in the Rain. You decide. Jennifer Van Dyke narrates.
Robert looked down at Jenna and paused. Is that what you're wearing? He got down off the counter. Jenna felt dazed. As she watched Robert, she could feel a thickening in her neck. Her feet were getting heavy. Robert took one of the candles out of the bag and placed it on a plate. He lit it with a wooden match from the Rain City Grill. Jenna watched silently. When the candle was lit, Robert moved to Jenna's side and took up her hand. It's the anniversary. The anniversary. The anniversary, the second anniversary, in the year of our Lord, year 2, A.D., after death. The Lord Jesus will protect and shelter you from harm. Blessed be the fruit of thy womb. Robert lights a candle on the anniversary. You can drown in a mud puddle, hit your head, drown in a puddle, like Graham's brother when he was little, got hit on the head with a swing. An ocean, a river, a bathtub. But you can't drown yourself. No way. It only comes to those who don't want it. You can't always get what you want. The tears filled her eyes, rolled down her cheeks, hot tears. She stood shaking, looking at nothing, tears rolling down her cheeks, hitting the floor. Robert watched her, not realizing what he had done. She cried black tears. Her lip quivered as she breathed. She looked so nice. So nice for a party on the anniversary. Little drops of hot black water on the floor. She couldn't move. Her arms and legs were numb, paralyzed. He looked at her. He cried out. He said, "Mommy, Mommy." A gallon of water weighs 8 pounds. A sweater filled with water weighs 800 pounds. Holds your arms down at your sides. Makes it so you can't move. Survival instinct isn't smart enough to beat a wet sweater and waffle stompers. Like a rock. Straight to the bottom. Little. Less. Nothing.
Okay, I admit it. I'm a sucker for dog books. The Book Report even devoted an entire show to dog books. Check it out on my website, bookreportradio.com, archive books for August 20th and 21st. So yes, I loved A Dog's Purpose by W. Bruce Cameron. Admit it, you did too. We previewed that title last December. You'll find it in archived shows December 11th and 12th. So, I was excited to see that the author has just come out with a new title, Emery's Gift. He narrates it, too. After 13-year-old Charlie Hall's mother dies and his father retreats into the silence of grief, Charlie finds himself drifting, lost and alone, through the brutal halls of junior high. But Charlie Hall is not entirely friendless. In the woods behind his house, Charlie is saved from a mountain lion by a grizzly bear, a species thought to be extinct in northern Idaho. And this very unusual bear will change Charlie's life forever. Moving and interwoven with hope, Emery's Gift is not only a charming coming-of-age story, but also a page-turning insight, a look at how faith, trust, and unconditional love can heal a broken family and bridge the gaps that divide us.
I've read that the chances of a person dying from a bear attack are about the same as a person dying from a lightning strike. I've always thought, though, that if you actually are hit by lightning, your odds of dying from it go up dramatically. The same might be said about the mighty grizzly, an amazing top-of-the-food-chain predator with astoundingly sharp claws, flesh-tearing teeth, and powerful jaws. Your best chance of surviving a grizzly attack is not to have one. When the bear I thought might be Emery turned toward me, I saw two things immediately. First, it wasn't Emery. The black stare from those eyes was entirely different from the warm intelligence I remembered in Emery's gaze. Second, this bear was spooked, as stressed as bears get. And I, of course, was the source of his stress. I heard his teeth clank together like a metal gate banging shut, three quick, successive bites at the air that told me this bear felt his life threatened by my approach. His life threatened. Saliva flew. When grizzly bears are about to attack, they drool, adding a menacing sheen to their long, sharp fangs. And, just before they charge, they pound the ground with their feet. I had a canister of bear repellent attached to my belt. My belt was maybe 15 or 20 yards behind me, lying where I'd tossed it. I spread my arms wide, letting the bear know I was just human, nothing to be afraid of. "I'm sorry," I said in a quaking voice. The bear slammed his front paws down on the dirt. I took a slow, careful step backward. A grizzly bear can run 35 miles an hour and can turn more adroitly than a fleeing squirrel. He was 25 yards from me. If I sprinted for the bear spray, I might make it halfway. "It's okay," I said reassuringly, trying to calm both of us. The bear showed me his teeth, snapping them together, saliva flying. "Please." I took another step backward. The bear pounded his paws on the dirt. I inhaled carefully. He charged. 800 pounds of angry tooth and claw came at me with his head low and his murderous gaze intent. "Run!" my inner voice screamed. It was a straightforward attack, swift and silent. "Run!" But I stood, holding my ground. "Hey," I said tremulously, and he was there, right there, so close I felt the blast of heat from his breath as he chuffed at me and veered away. He ran another 10 feet laterally and then stopped, staring at me. They call it a bluff charge. Among bear experts, there's a joke. It's only called a bluff charge by the people who live through one. For everyone else, it's just a charge. A bear feels threatened and he wants you to leave, so he storms at you, makes it clear that this is the one warning you're going to receive.
Ian McEwan is a British novelist and screenwriter, and one of England's most highly regarded writers. In 2008, The Times named him to their list of 50 greatest British writers since 1945. Of course, many of us read Atonement or saw the Oscar-winning film. His newest work is Solar, and we're going to take a look at it now. Some people deserve everything horrible that happens to them. Michael Beard is definitely one of those people. The Nobel Prize-winning physicist is fast approaching 60, a mere shell of the academic titan he once was. While his fifth marriage is falling apart, Michael suddenly finds himself with an unexpected opportunity to reinvigorate his career and possibly save humankind from the growing threat of global warming. Sounds noble on the surface, but Beard only really seems to care about finding a fashionable subject to research and receiving a lucrative six-figure paycheck for doing as little work as possible. Narrator Roger Allam has one of those precise, slightly condescending, upper-crust English accents that perfectly suits Beard's character. This audio title includes an exclusive interview with the author. Let's listen.
No woman had ever looked or sounded so desirable as the wife he suddenly could not have. Conspicuously, he went to Lisbon to look up an old friend, but it was a joyless 3 nights. He had to have his wife back, and dared not drive her away with shouting or threats or brilliant moments of unreason. Nor was it in his nature to plead. He was frozen. He was abject. He could think of nothing else. The first time she left him a note, "Staying over at ours tonight, XXP." Did he go round to the mock Tudor ex-council semi with the shrouded speedboat on the hard standing and a hot tub in the pint-sized backyard to mash the man's brains with his own monkey wrench? No. He watched television for 5 hours in his overcoat, drank 2 bottles of wine, and tried not to think. And failed. But thinking was all he had. When his other wives had found out about his affairs, they raged, coldly or tearfully. They insisted on long sessions into the early hours to deliver their thoughts on broken trust, and eventually their demands for a separation and all that followed. But when Patrice happened across some emails from Suzanne Rubin, a mathematician at the Humboldt University in Berlin, she became unnaturally elated. That same afternoon, she moved her clothes into the guest bedroom. It was a shock when he slid the wardrobe doors open to confirm the fact. Those rows of silk and cotton dresses, he realized now, had been a luxury and a comfort, versions of herself lining up to please him. No longer. Even the hangers were gone. She smiled through dinner that night as she explained that she too intended to be free, and within the week she had started her affair. What was a man to do? He apologized one breakfast, told her his lapse meant nothing, made grand promises he sincerely believed he might keep. This was the closest he came to pleading. She said she did not mind what he did. This was what she was doing, and this was when she revealed the identity of her lover, the builder with the sinister name of Rodney Tarpin, 7 inches taller and 20 years younger than the cuckold, whose sole reading, according to his boast, back when he was humbly grouting and bevelling for the beards, was the sports section of a tabloid newspaper. An early sign of Beard's distress was dysmorphia, or perhaps it was dysmorphia he was suddenly cured of. At last, he knew himself for what he was. Catching sight of a conical pink mess in the misted full-length mirror as he came out of the shower, he wiped down the glass, stood full on, and took a disbelieving look. What engines of self-persuasion had let him think for so many years that looking like this was seductive? That foolish thatch of earlobe-level hair that buttressed his baldness, the new curtain swag of fat that hung below his armpits, the innocent stupidity of swelling in gut and rear. Once he had been able to improve on his mirror self by pinning back his shoulders, standing erect, tightening his abs. Now human blubber draped his efforts. How could he possibly keep hold of a young woman as beautiful as she was? Had he honestly thought that status was enough, that his Nobel Prize would keep her in his bed? Naked, he was a disgrace, an idiot, a weakling. Even 8 consecutive press-ups were beyond him, whereas Tarpin could run up the stairs to the Beard's master bedroom, holding under one arm a 50-kilo cement sack. 50 kilos! That was roughly Patrice's weight. She kept him at a distance with lethal cheerfulness. These were additional insults, her sing-song hellos, the matinal recital of domestic detail, and her evening whereabouts.
A Spot of Bother is Mark Haddon's unforgettable follow-up to the international bestseller The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. Quirky, yes. Thoroughly enjoyable, you betcha. At 61, George Hall is settling down to a comfortable retirement. Then his tempestuous daughter, Katie, announces she is getting remarried to the deeply inappropriate Ray. Her family is not pleased, and Katie can't decide if she loves Ray or loves the wonderful way he has with her son, Jacob. Her mother, Jean, is a bit put out by all the planning and arguing the wedding has occasioned, which get in the way of her quite fulfilling late-life affair with one of her husband's ex-colleagues. And the tidy and pleasant life George and Jean's son, Jamie, has created crumbles when he fails to invite his lover, Tony, to the dreaded nuptials. Here, the madness of family life proves rich comic fodder for Haddon's crackling prose and insights into misdirected love. And the bonus for you? The title is narrated by Simon Vance.
George realized that he was crouching on the tiled threshold outside the shop.
Sir?
George got to his feet.
I'm terribly sorry.
Would you mind accompanying me? George looked down and saw that he was still wearing the suit trousers with the fly undone. He buttoned it rapidly.
Of course.
He walked back through the doors, then made his way between the handbags and the perfumes toward the menswear department with the security guard at his shoulder.
I appear to have had some kind of turn.
You'll have to discuss that with the manager, I'm afraid, sir. The black thoughts which had filled his mind only seconds before seemed to have occurred a very long time ago. True, he was a little unsure on his feet, the way you were after slicing your thumb with a chisel, for example, but he felt surprisingly good, given the circumstances. The manager of the menswear department was standing beside a rack of slippers, with his hands crossed over his groin.
Thank you, John.
The security guard gave him a deferential little nod, turned on his heels, and walked away.
Now, Mr.
Hall, George Hall, my apologies, I...
Perhaps we should have a word in my office, said the manager.
A woman appeared, carrying George's trousers.
He left these in the changing room, his wallet's in the pocket.
George pressed on.
I think I had some kind of blackout. I really didn't mean to cause any trouble. How good it was to be talking to other people. Them saying something. Him saying something in return. The steady tick-tock of conversation. He could have carried on like this all afternoon.
Are you all right, sir?
The woman cupped a hand beneath his elbow, and he slid downward and sideways onto a chair which felt more solid, more comfortable, and more supportive than he remembered any chair ever feeling. Things became slightly vague for a few minutes. Then a cup of tea was placed into his hands.
Thank you.
He sipped. It was not good tea, but it was hot. It was in a proper china mug, and holding it was a comfort.
Perhaps we should call you a taxi.
It was probably best, he thought, to head back to the village and buy the suit another day. 2. He decided not to mention the incident to Jean. She would only want to talk about it, and this was not an appealing proposition. Talking was, in George's opinion, overrated. You could not turn the television on these days without seeing someone discussing their adoption or explaining why they had stabbed their husband. Not that he was averse to talking. Talking was one of life's pleasures, and everyone needed to sound off now and then over a pint of Ruddles about colleagues who did not shower frequently enough, or teenage sons who had returned home drunk in the small hours and thrown up in the dog's basket. But it did not change anything. The secret of contentment, George felt, lay in ignoring many things completely. How anyone could work in the same office for 10 years or bring up children without putting certain thoughts permanently to the back of their mind was beyond him. And as for that last grim lap when you had a catheter and no teeth, memory loss seemed like a godsend. He told Jean that he had found nothing in Alders and would drive back into town on Monday when he did not have to share Peterborough with 40,000 other people. Then he went upstairs to the bathroom and stuck a large plaster over the lesion so that it could no longer be seen. He slept soundly for most of the night and woke only when Ronald Burrows, his long-dead geography teacher, pressed a strip of duct tape over his mouth and hammered a hole through the wall of George's chest with a long metal spike. Oddly, it was the smell which upset him most. A smell like the smell of a poorly cleaned public toilet which has recently been used by a very ill person, heady and curried. A smell, worst of all, which seemed to be coming from the wound in his own body. He fixed his eyes on the lampshade above his head and waited for his heart to slow down, like a man pulled from a burning building, still not quite able to believe that he is safe. 6 o'clock. He slid out of bed and went downstairs. He put 2 slices of bread into the toaster and took down the espresso maker Jamie had given them for Christmas. It was a ridiculous gadget which they kept on show for diplomatic reasons, but it felt good now, filling the reservoir with water, pouring coffee into the funnel, slotting the rubber seal into place and screwing the aluminium sections together. Oddly reminiscent of Gareth's steam engine, which George had been allowed to play with during the infamous visit to Poole in 1953, and a good deal better than sitting watching the trees at the far end of the garden swaying like sea monsters while a kettle boiled. The blue flame sighed under the metal base of the coffee maker. Indoor camping. A bit of an adventure. The toast pinged up. That was the weekend, of course, when Gareth burned the frog. How strange, looking back, that the course of an entire life should be spelled out so clearly in 5 minutes during one August afternoon. He spread butter and marmalade on the toast while the coffee gargled through. He poured the coffee into a mug and took a sip. It was hair-raisingly strong. He added milk till it became the colour of dark chocolate, then sat down and picked up the RIBA journal, which Jamie had left on his last visit.
If you love chick lit, I bet your Jimmy Choo's you've read and or seen one of the movies of the Shopaholic series by Sophie Kinsella. starring the adorable Becky Bloomwood, a fashionable, slightly feather-brained financial journalist who cannot manage her own finances. But holy Manolo, did you know that Sophie Kinsella is actually the pen name for Madeline Wickham? The intrepid and prolific Wickham started her writing career as a financial journalist, before turning to fiction. Her first novel, The Tennis Party, has just been re-released as 40 Love, and we're going to serve up the preview. Everyone wins this game of literary tennis, a comedy of manners about envy, in which Wickham skewers the nouveau riche. At their country estate, Patrick Chance and his wife host a weekend tennis party. As four couples gather on the sunny terrace, it seems obvious who among them is succeeding and who is falling behind. By the end of the party, nothing will be quite as certain. While the couple's children amuse themselves with pony rides and plays, the adults suffer a series of personal revelations and crises. Wickham's nonstop action reveals one thing is crystal clear. The weekend is about anything but tennis. Catherine Kellgren narrates.
She had no idea whether a rising trot was supposed to be controlled or utterly abandoned. And my jumping's getting better, added Georgina. Oh, good, darling, said Caroline. Her voice was husky, roughened by cigarettes, and lately a bottle of white wine nearly every evening.
Nail varnish, said Georgina. Can I put some on?
Not on those filthy nails, said Caroline. You need a bath.
Can I, when I've had my bath?
Maybe, if I have time.
I want bright pink.
I haven't got any bright pink, said Caroline, wrinkling her nose. You can have this pretty pale pink or red.
Red? Ugh!
Georgina pulled a face. Then she jumped up onto the terrace and swung on the back of Caroline's beechwood chair.
Who's coming tomorrow?
You know who's coming, said Caroline, carefully applying a second coat to her left foot.
Nicola's coming, isn't she? Is she better yet?
Getting better.
Shall I take her riding? Is she allowed?
You'll have to ask Annie. I don't see why not, but make sure you take Toby, too.
He's too little to go on Arabia.
All right, then, he can watch.
Can I be in the tennis tournament?
No.
Can I wear my tennis skirt?
If you want to.
Can I be ball girl?
You can if you want, said Caroline, but you'll get bored.
No, I won't, said Georgina. I know how to do it. You roll the balls along the line, and then you hold them up and throw them to the people playing. Poppy Warburton's cousin was a ball girl in Wimbledon, and she saw Navratilova. I can serve overhead, too.
She threw up an imaginary ball and took a swipe at it, bumping into Caroline's chair as she did so. The nail varnish brush smudged, said Caroline without rancor.
No one's going to see your feet anyway, said Georgina. Will you put some on my fingers?
After your bath, you need clean nails. Yours are all horsey. But Georgina had lost interest and was doing a handspring on the lawn. Caroline, who had once trained as a gymnast herself, looked up. They didn't teach them to finish off properly anymore, she thought, to land neatly and present to the judges with a pretty smile. At Georgina's boarding school, no one took gymnastics seriously. They did it to strengthen the girls for more important pursuits, netball, lacrosse, and always the horses. None of them seemed interested in competitions, show routines, shiny leotards and ribbons, the stuff of which Caroline's childhood had been made. Patrick Chance, walking up to the house from the tennis court, saw his beautiful, agile daughter turning cartwheels against the setting sun and stopped for a moment, taking in her effortless grace, her vitality and energy. Was every father as sentimental as he? He found it difficult talking to other parents to emulate their easy nonchalance. Whereas they shrugged off their children's achievements, he could not resist cataloguing Georgina's. Could never resist breaking off in conversation to point out that his daughter had just gone into the ring, yes, competing in the under-14s, even though she was only just 11. When the other parents nodded, smiling, and turned back to their chatter, his heart would beat with suppressed rage and incomprehension. But look at her, he always wanted to cry. Just look at her. She plays the piano, too, he would say, desperate to win back their attention. Coming on very well, her teacher says. We thought we might try her on the flute. Caroline, he noticed, had turned her attention back to her nail polish. It still pained him that she didn't share his fervent appreciation of Georgina, and refused to join in when he began to eulogize about her, even when they were together on their own. Particularly because, to be fair, there was a lot more in Georgina that Caroline could claim as her own than he could. Mother and daughter shared their blonde hair, their athletic frames, their tendency to burst into raucous laughter. But perhaps that was why Caroline was so blasé about Georgina. She was used to beauty, physical accomplishment, and popularity. Whereas Patrick, short, stumpy, and short-sighted, was not. He continued walking towards the house, and Georgina started walking towards him in a crab.
"Hello, Daddy,"
she panted, and collapsed on the ground. "Hello, kitten," he said. "Good riding lesson."
"Brilliant."
He looked up at Caroline. "Everything under control for tomorrow?"
"The food's on the plates, if that's what you mean," said Caroline. "And Mrs. Finch went over the bedrooms this morning."
Every book club I knew read The Alchemist. Not exactly my cup of tea, but it was read and discussed by millions. So I thought you might enjoy a glimpse into Aleph, Paulo Coelho's frank and surprising personal story, a transformative journey of self-discovery. Facing a grave crisis of faith and seeking a path of spiritual renewal and growth, Paulo decides to start over, to travel, to experiment, to reconnect with people and the world. On this journey through Europe, Africa, and aboard the Trans-Siberian Railway to Asia, he will again meet Hilal, the woman he loved 500 years before, and the woman he betrayed in an act of cowardice. Together, they initiate a mystical voyage through time and space, through past and present, in search of himself and his path to revitalize his energy and his passion. Aleph invites us to consider the meaning of our own personal journeys. Are we where we want to be, doing what we want to do? Mark Bramall narrates.
Oh no, not another ritual. Not another invocation intended to make the invisible forces manifest in the visible world. What has that got to do with the world we live in today? Graduates leave university and can't find a job. Old people reach retirement and have almost nothing to live on. Grown-ups have no time to dream, struggling from 9 to 5 to support their families and pay for their children's education, always bumping up against the thing we all know as harsh reality. The world has never been as divided as it is now, what with religious wars, genocides, a lack of respect for the planet, economic crises, depression, poverty, with everyone wanting instant solutions to at least some of the world's problems, or their own. And things look only bleaker as we head into the future. What am I doing here, trying to make my way in a spiritual tradition whose roots are in the remote past, far from all the challenges of the present moment? Along with Jay, whom I call my master, although I'm beginning to have doubts about that, I am walking toward the sacred oak tree, which for more than 500 years has stood there, impassively contemplating humanity's woes, its one concern being to surrender its leaves in winter and recover them in spring. I can't stand to write any more about my relationship with Jay, my guide in the tradition. I have dozens of diaries full of notes of our conversations, which I never bothered to reread. Since our first meeting in Amsterdam in 1982, I have learned and unlearned how to live hundreds of times. Whenever Jay teaches me something new, I think that perhaps this will be the last step required to reach the top of the mountain, the note that justifies a whole symphony, the word that sums up an entire book. I go through a period of euphoria, which gradually dissipates. Some things stay forever, but most of the exercises, practices, and teachings end up disappearing down a black hole, or so it seems. The ground is wet. It occurs to me that my sneakers, meticulously washed 2 days before, will soon be covered in mud again, however carefully I tread. My search for wisdom, peace of mind, and an awareness of realities, visible and invisible, has become routine and pointless. I began my apprenticeship in magic when I was 22. I followed various paths, walked along the very edge of the abyss for many years, slipped and fell, gave up, and started all over again. I imagined that by the time I reached the age of 59, I would be close to paradise and to the absolute peace I thought I could see in the smiles of Buddhist monks. In fact, I seem to be further from achieving that than ever. I'm not at peace. Now and then I go through periods of inner conflict that can persist for months, and the times when I immerse myself in some magical reality last only seconds, just long enough to know that another world exists, and long enough to leave me frustrated because I can't absorb everything I learn. We arrive. When the ritual is over, I'll have a serious talk with him. We both place our hands on the trunk of the sacred oak. Jay says a Sufi prayer. O God, when I listen to the voices of animals, the sounds of trees, the murmurings of water, the singing of birds, the whistling of the wind, or the boom of thunder, I see in them evidence of your unity. I feel that you are supreme power, omniscience, supreme knowledge, and supreme justice. I recognize you, O God, in the trials I am going through. May your pleasure be my pleasure too. May I be your joy, the joy that a father feels for a son. And may I think of you calmly and with determination, even when I find it hard to say, I love you. Usually at this point, I would feel, for only a fraction of a second, but that's always enough, the one presence that moves the sun and the earth and ensures that the stars remain in their places. But I don't feel like talking to the universe today. I just want the man at my side to give me the answers I need.
Guest Michaela Hamilton has had a long, distinguished career in publishing. At a recent writers' conference I attended, hopeful writers were clamoring to get a moment alone with her. Michaela joined Kensington Publishing Corp in October 2001 as editor-in-chief. In the fall of 2005, she was named editor-in-chief of the Citadel Press, which is Kensington's nonfiction imprint specializing in books about popular culture, memoirs, narrative nonfiction, and other general interest trade topics. In addition to managing the department, she acquires and edits commercial fiction and nonfiction for Kensington and Citadel, including hardcover, trade paperbacks, and mass market books. Prior to joining Kensington, she worked for 15 years at the New American Library, where she was promoted to editor-in-chief and associate publisher of Dutton. Her best-selling authors included Dr. Mehmet Oz, Stephen White, and Jeffrey Deaver, a recent guest of mine. Michaela describes herself as a die-hard bookworm with broad-ranging tastes. She hails from Pennsylvania and has a BA in English from Penn and an MBA from NYU. Welcome, Michaela. My listeners and I are thrilled you're able to speak with us today.
Oh, thank you. I'm very happy to be with you.
How did you get started in publishing?
I would have to say that ever since childhood, I did absolutely nothing but read books. I was just such a bookworm from the very beginning. My mom read stories to me, and then I read stories to her, and I just kept reading. So I was an English major as an undergraduate, and the reason I chose the major was that I just wanted to read as many books as I possibly could. When I was a child, I had the lifetime ambition that I would read every book ever written. And I think I've come pretty close, but I've had to back off from that goal and just say that I still love to read just as much as I did at the beginning of my career.
Well, when you started, was it difficult for a woman to get one of the top jobs in the field, and how has that changed?
I would have to say that during my career in publishing, which is almost 40 years now, women have held the top jobs. I would say that women probably had a hard time getting paid on an equal basis with the men who had the jobs. But in publishing, women have traditionally held a lot of power, which is a great thing, and I think that as far as the salaries go, we've probably caught up by now.
When you are at a conference like the one in Cape Cod, you are so swamped by, aspiring writers. What advice would you give new writers? How can they make their work stand out?
My advice would be to write for a specific audience. I would say that it's very important to think about the reader of your book and what other books are going to be on that reader's bookshelf or in their e-reader. What movies have they seen recently? Think about the people that you're writing for. And there are certain genres of books that are very receptive to new authors. For instance, romance, thrillers, mysteries. The fans of those genres are always looking for new favorite authors. So if you, for instance, are interested in writing a mystery, I would say read as many mysteries as you can. Try to understand what the readers like about the most successful mystery series. And then try to deliver the same kind of satisfaction to the reader, but give it your own unique and original and fresh voice.
Do you suggest for aspiring writers to hire an agent?
Well, I wouldn't say for aspiring writers. You have to have at least one manuscript completely written before an agent will really be interested in you. It is better to have an agent when you're seeking a publisher. However, I think that a writer has to develop a career to a certain level before it really makes sense to pay an agent that commission that's coming out of your writing income.
And what about a professional editor?
Yes, I definitely recommend having your work professionally edited. You have to remember that when you submit your book, whether it's to an agent or an editor, those people are swamped with reading, and they will have very little tolerance for any piece of writing that contains typos or sloppy errors. So it is really worthwhile making sure that your work is the best it can possibly be before you ask a professional to look at it.
I have to ask the question, how have ebooks changed your industry?
They have changed the industry in many ways for the better, unfortunately to the detriment of printed books. We are seeing print numbers go down at the same time that ebook numbers are going up. To me, the important thing is that people are still reading. I really love books. I love printed books. I love the feel of them and the smell of them and just looking at them. They're so exciting. But I have to admit that I also read a lot on my e-reader. So I think the important thing is that there's a need for storytelling, there's a need for inspiration, there's a need for information, and the format may vary, but what we have to give readers remains the same.
Do you think that self-publishing makes sense for a new writer to kind of help them gain an audience, or talk about self-publishing for a while?
I think self-publishing is very exciting, and I do think that it's a good route for a new writer to go. If you can't get an agent and you can't get a major publisher interested after, I don't know, a year or so, I would say, think about self-publishing. Think about how you would do it yourself. If you later go to a publisher and you have some kind of a track record as a self-published author who sold some copies and generated some publicity and created a bit of a following, then you're more likely to get attention from an agent or an editor later on.
Do reading trends differ in in different times? I mean, in turbulent times such as these, do different genres rise to the top?
One thing we've discovered is that romance fans will always want to buy romance books, no matter what the economy is doing, no matter what current affairs are happening. Fans of romance are very, very loyal. And I think that that's also true of other genres of fiction that offer escape and entertainment. I think that when times get rough, we need escape and entertainment more than ever. I think it's, unfortunately, the more serious books and the more serious works of nonfiction that suffer when the economy turns down. But I do think that for books of that nature, the authors are increasingly reaching their readers through blogs and e-shorts and other media.
All right. Well, my listeners know that I'm a former Library of Congress staffer, so I have to ask, what role do you see libraries playing today and into the future?
I love libraries, and I really hope that they're going to maintain their vital role. I know that for me as a book lover, libraries are always very important as a source of new and exciting ideas and new favorite authors, and I spend a lot of time in libraries. I think that libraries have actually done an incredible job of adapting to new technology already, and I understand that there are some plans now for libraries to be able to lend e-books in the future. I think that's one innovation that we'll probably see before too long. And I just hope that the brick-and-mortar libraries can maintain their status as such an important cultural vantage point in many communities.
Mm-hmm. Okay, here's a delicate question. As an editor, I'm sure this has happened to you when you have a kind of a famous author turn in a book and it seems pretty cookie cutter, not up to their greatest titles. How do you deal with that? It seems like so many authors or many authors these days are kind of just cranking them out, writing with someone else, having someone else write the book and just add their name to it. What's your opinion of that, and how do you deal with that?
As an editor, I want every book to be as good as it possibly can, but the relationship with each author will vary. Some authors are very eager for editing, and some really are not very receptive to it at all. So I think editors just have to do the best they can to help the author. When I started my career, I edited a novel for an author who paid me the highest compliment. He said having his book edited by me was like having someone scratch his back in a place that he couldn't reach. I feel that I can give the authors a perspective that they couldn't possibly have after being immersed in one book for the better part of the year. Of course you would lose perspective. So as I often say to my authors, honey, I just can't let you go out in public with spinach in your teeth. It's my job to make sure that that book is the most polished and perfect piece of writing it can possibly be.
Thank you for joining us today. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much for the conversation. I've enjoyed it.
Bye.
Okay, bye now.
André Dubus III begins his memoir, Townie, with a Bruce Springsteen lyric about boys trying to look tough. The quotation sets the tone for the book, which tackles the grit, the drugs, and the street fights that accounted for much of the author's experience growing up in a small New England town in the 1970s. The book is his reflection on the violent lifestyle that threatened to destroy him until he was saved by writing. André's first book, The House of Sand and Fog, was a finalist for the National Book Award. The incredibly popular title featured prose that was precise, deliberate, and meticulously crafted. In this title, the author narrates, making Townie a raw and personal listening experience. After his parents divorced in the 1970s, André and his three siblings grew up with their exhausted working mother in a depressed Massachusetts mill town saturated with drugs and crime. To protect himself and those he loved from street violence, André learned to use his fists. He was on a fast track to getting killed or killing someone else, or to beatings for pay as a boxer. Nearby, his father, an eminent author, taught on a college campus and took the kids out on Sundays. The clash of worlds couldn't have been more stark or more difficult for a son to communicate to a father. Only by becoming a writer himself could Andre begin to bridge the abyss and save himself. His memoir is a riveting, visceral meditation on physical violence and the failures and triumphs of love.
This was the 60s and early 70s. Nobody jogged then. It was a habit he'd formed in the Marine Corps, and when he ran down the road, people would shout from their lawns and ask if he needed any help. Where was he going? I had run with him once before when I was 8 years old. It was at our old house in the woods in New Hampshire, one with land to play on, a clear brook in the trees. It was a summer day when Mom and Pop were still married, and Pop had asked me and Jeb if we wanted to go with him. We said yes, though Jeb lost interest pretty quickly and walked back down the country road Pop and I kept running on. I lagged a few feet behind him, the sun on my face, sweat burning my eyes. At the 1 mile mark, he turned around and I followed him home where he left me and set back out on a longer run. But I'd run 2 miles, and when I stepped inside our cool, dark house, I yelled up the stairs to Mom, "I ran 2 miles with Daddy, Mom! I'm strong! I'm strong!" And I punched the wall and could feel the plaster and lath behind the wallpaper, though I had no words for them. Niall was twice that age and hadn't run since, and even though my feet hurt with each stride, it felt good to be running outside with Pop on his birthday, spending time with him that wasn't in a restaurant he couldn't afford on a Sunday, that wasn't in a small apartment every fourth Wednesday. It was easier not having to look directly at him across the table, to have him sometimes look directly at me, and this was a part of town I didn't even know about. For a while, it was hard to believe it was the same town as the one I spent all my time in. We were running on a wide dirt trail under a canopy of leafy branches. To our left, the trees grew on a slope and leaned over the water. To our right was a steep wooded hill, the ground a bed of pine needles and moss-covered rock, deep green ferns growing up around fallen logs and bare branches. I was in weight training shape, not running shape. And 15 minutes into it, I could hear myself breathing harder than he was. But I didn't let myself fall behind him, and I found if I relaxed my toes each time I lifted a foot, then tensed them just before it hit the ground again, the pain wasn't quite as sharp. I figured I'd have to do this another 30 minutes, maybe 45, just two or three times what we'd already done. I could do that, right? The trail dropped closer to the water, and for a quarter mile or so we were running on flat ground, water on both sides of us, marsh grass and lily pads and waterlogged trees that had been there for years. Then the hills came. They were short and steep, and Pop told me to run up them hard, that it was easier that way. I did, my heart punching my ribs, my breathing coming too shallow when I was inhaling as deeply as I could. Pop was 8 or 10 feet ahead of me now. Then I put my head down, pumped my arms and legs, and tried to ignore the stabs in my soles, the vice on my toes, the metal grater on my heels. The hill leveled off in the shade, then dropped mercifully before another rose up like a rock-strewn wave, and now my eyes were stinging from the sweat, and I closed them and ran as hard as I could, my thighs burning, the air in my lungs gone for good. There were 5 or 6 more like this, and with each one we rose higher from the water down to our left. To our right was the rise of another densely wooded hill, so shaded it looked cool, and Pop was breathing much easier than I was, his bandana dark with sweat. He seemed to slow himself so I could pull up beside him. "The big one's coming up." "Big one? You'll see." He laughed, and soon enough the trail cut hard to the east, and he ran ahead of me. I followed, but this was the steepest hill yet. And when I looked ahead, I saw only that it kept rising and rising before it curved into more trees where it rose again. My mouth and throat were thick and tasted like salt. My thighs hurt almost as much as my feet, and even though I was pumping my arms and legs as fast as I could, I seemed to be barely moving. I couldn't see my father anymore. I closed my eyes and kept running. Pop was waiting for me at the top, running in place, his beard glistening in the dappled light. He was smiling at me. When I got to where he was, we ran side by side down a long, winding trail in the shade. It wasn't until we were on flat ground again, water on both sides of us, maybe 1.5 miles before we were through, that he said, "You up for the second lap?" "Yeah." I assumed the second lap meant the home stretch we were running, the same trail we'd used on the way in. I didn't know then that on his birthday every year he would double or triple his normal running distance, that the second lap meant another 5.5 miles after I somehow got through these.
Charlie Davidson, Grim Reaper extraordinaire, is back in Second Grave on the Left, a sexy novel of supernatural shenanigans. If you remember, we previewed First Grave on the Right, and we had a fun interview with the author, Dorinda Jones. Checked archive shows on bookreportradio.com the week of February 19th and 20th. In book two, Charlie is rudely awakened in the middle of the night by her best friend, who tells her to get dressed. Cookie explains that her friend Mimi had disappeared 5 days earlier, and Cookie has just received a text from her setting up a meet in a downtown coffee shop. The duo show up, but no Mimi. Charlie finds a message on the bathroom wall. Mimi has left a clue, a woman's name, an old friend of hers from high school who had just been found murdered. Meanwhile, Reyes Alexander Faro, otherwise known as the Son of Satan, yes, the Son of the Satan, has left his corporeal body and is haunting Charlie. Why has he left his body, you ask? Because he is being tortured by demons who want to lure Charlie closer. And if the demons get to Charlie, they'll have a portal to heaven. And if they have a portal to heaven, well, let's just say it won't be pretty. It's all in good fun. Quite the supernatural romp. Read by Lorelei King.
I ground my teeth together and used all my energy to anchor myself to Earth. Mustn't go into the light. Are you even listening to me? Cookie's voice was muffled now as she rummaged through my personal effects. She was so lucky my killer instincts hadn't kicked in and pummeled her to the ground, left her a bruised and broken woman, groaning in agony, twitching occasionally. Charlie, for heaven's sake! Darkness suddenly enveloped me as an article of clothing smacked me in the face, which was completely uncalled for. For heaven's sake, back, I said in a groggy voice, wrestling the growing pile of clothes off my head. What are you doing? Getting you dressed. I'm already as dressed as I want to be it. I glanced at the digits glowing atop my nightstand. 2 o'clock in the freaking morning. Seriously? Seriously. She threw something else. Her aim being what it was, the lamp on my nightstand went flying. The lampshade landed at my feet. Put that on. The lampshade? But she was gone. It was weird. She rushed out the door, leaving an eerie silence in her wake. The kind that makes one's lids grow heavy, one's breathing rhythmic, deep, and steady. Charlie! I jumped out of my skin at the sound of Cookie screeching, and having flailed, almost fell out of bed. Man, she had a set of lungs. She'd yelled from her apartment across the hall. You're gonna wake the dead, I yelled back. I didn't deal well with the dead at 2 in the morning. Who did? I'm gonna do more than that if you don't get your ass out of bed. For a best friend slash neighbor slash dirt cheap receptionist, Cookie was getting pushy. We'd both moved into our respective apartments across the hall from each other 3 years ago. I was fresh out of the Peace Corps, and she was fresh out of divorce court with one kid in tow. We were like those people who meet and just seem to know each other. When I opened my PI business, she offered to answer the phone until I could find someone more permanent, and the rest is history. She's been my slave ever since. I examined the articles of clothing strewn across my bedroom and lifted a couple in doubt. Bunny slippers and a leather miniskirt? I called out to her. Together? Like an ensemble? She stormed back into the room, hands on hips, her cropped black hair sticking every direction but down. And then she glared at me, the same glare my stepmother used to give me when I gave her the Nazi salute. That woman was so touchy about her resemblance to Hitler.
Readers, thanks so much for joining me today. I hope I provided some insight as to which authors you'd like to return to. This fall promises a rich, varied selection of new titles from the book world's most famous names. So, be sure to keep tuning in to the book report. I ought not have drank it now.